Welcome to Meet the Icon, and this week our icon is Whitley Strieber. In a moment, Farah Yerdoza and Larry Dickin will join us. Then later, Whitley Strieber. In The Wolfen, Whitley Strieber writes, "She examined her victim with her eyes. The flesh was not visible. It was under thick folds of clothing. She would have to plunge into the cloth and rip out the throat. All at once, she opened her nose and the rich smell of the world around her came back in. She listened up and down the street, only distant automobile traffic. Now was the time. She was down. She was pushing her nose past the cloth, slick, hot flesh, feeling her teeth scrape back and down, pressing her tongue against the deliciously salty skin, and ripping with all the strength in her jaw, and jumping back to the wall with the bloody throat in her mouth. Her job was over. She dropped back behind the wall and ate her trophy. It was rich and sweet with blood. Around her, the pack, very happy. As the pack continued their work, the organs were sniffed carefully. One lung, the stomach, the colon, they were all put aside because of rot. Then the pack ate in rank order. The mother took the brain. The father took a thigh and a buttock. When they had finished, they took apart the remains, piece by piece, and dropped them in a nearby lake. They kicked as much new snow as they could over the blood of their feast. When this was done, they went to a place they had seen earlier, a great meadow full of beautiful new snow that had been falling. They ran and danced in the snow, feeling the pleasure of their bodies, the joy of racing headlong across the circle. And because they knew no human was within earshot, they let go a joyous howl. The sound rose through the park, echoing off the buildings that surrounded it. Inside those buildings, a few wakeful people stirred, made restive by the cold and ancient terror that the sound communicated to man. Welcome to Meet the Icon, and we have an icon for sure, Whitley Strieber, and we'll be talking to him in a moment. Farah Yerdoza and Larry Dickin are together in Secaucus at our studio. Farah, how are you?
Hi, greetings from New Jersey. How are you?
Okay, it's great. It's always nice to talk to you. And Larry Dickin, you've been reading Whitley Strieber since his first book, I think.
Yes, I have, and incidentally, welcome to New Jersey from me, too, just like we do every week.
But it's one of those assumed things. You're right.
Right.
Maybe we shouldn't assume it. You're welcome.
And I have indeed read just about all of Whitley's communion books, On the Grays, and an excellent series. And I'm certainly looking forward to reading the new one, and also understanding is a movie deal in the works here, and I'm looking forward to seeing the movie, that's for sure.
We'll find out about it when we talk to Whitley, for sure. He'll be on the line from his studio that he does the Dreamland show from every week out in Southern California. Farah, you actually met Whitley in person recently over in Manhattan.
Yes, last month he had a book signing day in Manhattan in a bookstore. And I wanted to meet him in person. I wanted to ask him if he wants to be a part of our show, and he agreed. But my meeting with Whitley Strieber books, it's 15 years ago. His first book that I found out was The Hunger, the vampire book. And I also watched that wonderful movie with Catherine Deneuve, Susan Sarandon, and David Bowie.
I understand what you're saying. You know, it appears to me, and you and I have had these discussions off the air,
yes,
that perhaps some of these horror book writings that he wrote earlier, that genre, They might have been influenced by the UFO, by the Greys as well.
Very much.
I know you're going to bring that up in the conversation, I bet you.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you'll
of
probably
course.
Ask him.
Yes, I will, because I really think that there is a connection between vampires and nighttime visitors, Greys or aliens.
Jerry?
Yes.
Just a little side comment on that, too, is remember our conversation this past year about the Spielberg treatment of the War of the Worlds and the fact that the ETs were portrayed as blood lovers, and they were actually herding people through New Jersey and picking them up and turning them into hamburger, and especially extracting the blood. All sounds very gory, but still and again, that theme of the need for blood.
We'll bring that up in the conversation with him as well, and we're going to talk about that movie deal he has. Whitley's no stranger to show business at all, and I mean that as a compliment. He's been around. Farrah, at your meeting with Whitley, you size up people. Everybody does when they meet them. What was your impression of him?
Well, it was a book signing day for Whitley Strieber and a friend of him. He was a photographer, and it was an interesting meeting because there was Whitley Strieber, a professional photographer, and a musician, a rock musician, Lou Reed, and there was a porn star. So there were four stars there, and each of them were a star in their own field. So it was a very crowded meeting, but each of them had their own fans. So obviously, me and my friends, we were interested in Whitley Strieber.
Well, you
I
know,
guess the porn star didn't fare well with you guys, huh?
Farrah, though, did right. She got the interview, and that's the
yes.
important part.
Yes,
in fact, we're going
nice.
To do the interview when we come back, as we meet the
okay.
icon, Whitley Strieber. Don't go away.
Okay.
My Search for the Afterlife is a book that explores real communications between a father and his deceased son. A rare number theory is developed during Dennis Spaulding's quest. My Search for the Afterlife is a book that shares a theory believed to help his son and other spirits validate the messages they sent across worlds. To learn more about this unique and moving book, visit their website at mysearchfortheafterlife.com. That's mysearchfortheafterlife.com.
Explain what is causing this weather and why it has taken them by surprise.
Oh my God, sudden drop in temperature as half an hour ago. Mexican officials closed the border in the line of so many U.S. refugees.
We prepare to go live to Los Angeles.
What you see is happening now.
Look over there behind me. That's a tornado. Yes, a twister.
This is just massive.
Lower Manhattan is virtually inaccessible.
A wall of water coming towards New York City. Everybody, get out!
That's from the soundtrack of The Day After Tomorrow, one of Whitley Strieber's masterpieces, and a great movie, by the way. We're back to meet the icon.
Save as many as you can.
And Whitley Strieber's on the line from Santa Monica. Whitley Farrah Yudoza will join us in a minute. But first of all, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the air with us. And I know we're going to have a great conversation. And I love your radio show, Dreamland. How long have you been doing that?
7 years.
It's an incredible show and very successful. And it's very interesting. I've listened to you week after week after week. And I can tell you from experience, it's not easy to come up with these guests, but you always manage to come up with a pretty good one.
Well, I've got a real expert sitting behind me in the office. My wife, Ann, does that.
And how's Ann doing these days?
Fabulous. Fabulous.
Good, good, good. Vera, why don't you say hello to Whitley?
Hello, Whitley. How are you?
Well, fine, thank you.
What's it like in Hollywood today, Whitley?
Well, I'm not in Hollywood, actually. Santa Monica, which is very different. It's cool and...
Yeah, I used to live in Santa Monica, so I know what you're talking about. Nice place.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Okay, Farah, we have Whitley on the phone, and I know you have a lot of things you want to talk to him about, and I'll let you start.
Yes, thank you. Well, here we have an extremely gray day in New Jersey. And gray aliens are coming back into our lives with your new book, Whitley. So we are very, very excited about this new book. And I would like to listen from you the story of this new book.
Well, the story of it is this. I went through 11 years of close encounters up until 1997, when I lived in upstate New York. And during that time, after the first few years, I quit writing about it because for two reasons. One, I didn't feel that the press was receptive enough, and I thought that what was happening was one of the most potentially valuable things that had ever happened. And I wanted to take my time in how I would address it. And I wanted to let it play out, and it did eventually play out, and it was a phenomenal life experience, I think one of the great life experiences of all time. And my responsibility became how do I make this valuable to others as it is to me. And I've written nonfiction about the Greys, as you know, with Communion, Transformation, and Breakthrough. And there is a limitation there, because everything this involves has to do with communication. There is a huge communications gap between us and them. It's much bigger than you can imagine. What they do in order to communicate meaningfully is much more different,
yes,
from what we do than what we do is from what dolphins do. And we're not really computing with each other at all. And I chose to go to writing fiction.
Yes, this time is a novel.
A novel, because it can communicate, the reader can live the experience in fiction in a way that in a nonfiction book is just not possible. Not possible.
Yes.
So that's why I did it as fiction. And they're saying, the reviewers are saying that the abduction sequences are vividly real. And another reason I did this fiction is that nobody who hadn't had these experiences, really had them, could write like this about them, and people know that. They know that instinctively. And people who understand writing, they know it literally. So the book is, in many ways, going to be much more convincing than the nonfiction books ever were.
It's a fiction, it's a novel, but also it is based on your own experiences, I think.
Very definitely.
Are you sharing more secrets, or are there more revelations in this book?
Well, it's not secrets. I'm not interested. I don't keep secrets. I tell everything I can tell. I mean, that I'm able, and I say can, not that I'm allowed to, but that I'm able to. Communicating about this is the critical thing. It's very, very hard to do, and I'm hoping that the flavor, the way it feels to have a relationship with the Greys, will come across through the book. And in the book also, there is material about an empath who works for the government in the book, in the fiction, and her experiences of learning how to communicate with the Greys are mine. This is what I did over the years, and how it felt, and what it resulted in.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a work of fiction that's also a textbook and a map of an emotional journey.
Personally, I can't wait to read it, and I can't wait to see the movie, because this book is going to be also a movie.
That's part of the effort, and I hope it comes into fruition. You never know with a movie, but I'm hopeful that the full expression of this will happen, and that on the other side of it, we'll have a different relationship with the Greys, maybe a more functional one. And by functional, I mean one that we gain value from, rather than simply being frightened of, and they will lash out at us, and they don't sometimes respect us the way we respect ourselves. They treat us more like animals, as you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to change all of that because I think this. I think basically if we gain a relationship with somebody from the outside, and the Greys, I chose the Greys because they're the ones I know. They're the ones that related to me. I know there are probably other visitors here, but they're the ones who had a relationship with me primarily. So that's why they're the stars of my story. But if we have, if we gain a relationship like this, then mankind gets to express ourselves into the cosmos. And just last week, Stephen Hawking said, if we don't do this, if we don't get out into the cosmos, we're going extinct. And he's dead right. That's the stakes. It's huge. The stakes are absolutely enormous. And I think that a gigantic factor in this is whether or not we are able to communicate and relate with beings from the outside. If we are, we're going to win big. If we aren't, then I think we risk extinction.
Whitley and Farah, can I jump in here and ask a question? You mentioned something that perked my interest, piqued it right off the bat, and that was the communication factor with the Greys and with humans. Could you go into that a little bit more? I mean, it's almost as if you're saying, and maybe I'm misreading something here, that we're talking past each other.
Well, it's not that we're talking past each other. It's that, well, first of all, they don't talk.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they...
Yeah, I was using that as a figurative.
Yeah, they can talk. I mean, they can generate voices that you can hear in two ways. One is audibly, using a machine that synthesizes voice, and the other is in your head, but neither of these with a sort of a microwave system. But neither of these is really them talking. They don't talk. They are not in the flow of time in the same way we are. Their experience of time is very different from ours. And this means that from our perception, when they try to communicate, it comes out as a kind it's really hard to put into words. That's why I wrote.
Yeah, I understand.
It comes out as a kind of a muddle, really, because it's a whole being and a whole body and a whole mind communication of a type that we simply don't have among ourselves.
Much more difficult than say, for instance, Farah, who's from Turkey, has a great accent, but I can understand her.
Well, it's much more difficult than that.
Yeah.
Well, for example, we talk in... We have this. We have this way of communicating potentially, but we convert it into a linear form and utter it through vocal cords. They don't have vocal cords. They don't utter that way. They don't speak that way. Therefore, their language doesn't really come into time the way ours does. And their language... temporally, in terms of time, they might say something that has meaning throughout millions of years. And, you know, how are you going to pick up on that?
Yeah.
You know, it's just really, really hard. And it takes a lot of careful reason. It takes extremely careful observation because it all happens very, very quickly. And it takes an emotional context. You have to be in the right emotional context. If you're too frightened or euphoric or any of those things, it does not work. They need you to be in a state of emotional balance. And that's what the character who plays the government empath in the book achieves, is this state of emotional balance. And then she can communicate with the Gray, and information flows unbelievably, and more than information. It involves an actual ascent into a whole other level of reality, something that we are capable of doing but we don't do. We're very capable of this. We're no less intelligent than the greys. Believe me, I know that from personal experience.
It is interesting that you mentioned about this talking process, because I was going to ask you, did you ever hear their voices when you had the communication, but you already gave me the answer.
Yeah, no, it's not. But there is an answer. There is another answer. The answer is yes.
Did you hear their voice?
They make sounds.
What kind of sounds?
I have heard. I'll give you an example. I spent weeks setting up a meeting with one of these grays at a certain place in the woods.
Yes.
The time of the meeting was chosen to be just at dawn, because there's a lot of issues. They have a lot of issues that I won't even get into about why they can't be in this comfortable in our sunlight, that have to do with science that's beyond where we are, so far beyond that it'd be a whole another show to even explain what the problem is. But in any case, if this person was going to be in the open air, it had to, and I didn't want it at night because it would be too frightening for me. So we chose this middle ground of just when dawn was coming. And I went down toward the woods, and unfortunately there came a voice in my head that was part of an automatic device that defends them from, it creates a defensive perimeter around wherever they are if they're exposed, and it spoke in words in such a frightening way that it stopped me and I couldn't go forward. I knew if I took another step forward I would be past it and it would be gone, but I just couldn't bear it, and I turned and I went back to the house, and when I put my hand on the doorknob there came three cries from the woods that were the most extraordinary sounds I have ever known. They were the richest, most emotionally filled, saddest sounds. And then there came a movement through the woods, and something invisible rushed into the house with me. And the next thing I knew, it was in contact with me. It had come anyway. And I experienced one of these incredible communications that threw my mind back into my babyhood, and suddenly, with an adult consciousness, I was reliving the first moment I walked as vividly as if it was happening again, but I knew and understood with an adult's mind what it was like to be in a baby's body. This is the way the grays communicate, and believe me, it is awesome. You understand the incredible intensity of what I'm describing from the whole thing.
Yes, yes, I can feel it right now from your voice. In fact, I'm sure it was extremely intense in that moment, and still it has the same effect on you. But I would like to ask you one thing. What was that invisible thing who came inside with you into the house?
Let's see, what are you talking about, Fair?
You said something invisible came with you.
If I could answer that question, I'd be farther along than I am. I would guess that it was the essence, in a way, of, or the gray itself, the being that I was supposed to meet, because this invisibility, which they say has to do with speed, incidentally, or communicated to me that it has to do with speed by demonstrating, is very much a part of the whole experience. They are often in this state, and sometimes it seems to be that they're in this state because of something about the way they are, and other times it's because of something that's technological. They use a kind of a hooded covering that makes them invisible, and incidentally, we are just in the process of discovering that. There was a story on our website, actually, about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, about an invisibility blanket that's being developed right now, and I think it's very similar to something that the Greys use.
It looks like a fairy tale.
Barry Mason, like something out of a science fiction magazine, but really, I've been reading about this kind of thing. Evidently, it is being developed. I've read several articles about it. When we continue with the next segment, Whitley Strieber will tell us about his relationship with a female gray. A truly close encounter of the third kind, for sure. Don't go away. Remember, August 22nd, The Grays will hit the bookstores. The Grays by Whitley Strieber, destined to be a bestseller. We'll be right back.
The doors are finally open at ShopJerryPippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features three different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at ShopJerryPippin.com.
People who face the visitors report fierce little figures with eyes that seem to stare into the deepest core of being. And those eyes are asking for something, perhaps even demanding it. It seems to me that it seeks the very depth of the soul. It seeks communion. That was a passage from the Whitley Strieber book, Communion. On the line from his radio studio in Southern California, we have Whitley Strieber. He has a new book out. On August 22nd, it will be released. It's called The Grays. As we open up this half hour, we'll continue talking to Whitley about his experiences with the Grays. In fact, Farah, I think you have a question for Whitley.
Yes. Though you have been having all these very intense experiences for a long time, and I know that sometime the female gray told you something. She said that you are the luckiest of the lucky. So do you feel yourself as the luckiest of the lucky?
I have been placed in a position of horrifying and agonizing responsibility, possessing what I believe to be among the most valuable things that any human being has ever possessed, and needing to communicate it to my species, which in turn needs it desperately and is turned away and will not listen. This should be being broadcast all over the world, and instead only a few of us have the intelligence and the courage and the insight to actually listen to this. And the openness of mind. Most of us, it doesn't matter. And the whole great machine of mankind goes rolling off toward the cliff that it is so quickly approaching. And if I'm lucky to be in that position, then yes, I am the luckiest of all.
Okay. And the other thing, in all these communications or in all these interactions with them, did they ever tell you their real origin? Did they ever tell you that they are extraterrestrials? They are coming from another planet?
No, I have no idea what they are. Not the faintest.
So, did you ever ask?
I tried. I got certain communications from time to time, yes.
But the answer is?
I don't think it's even a relevant question. I don't think it matters, and I don't think that we can... I don't think it's something that we can usefully answer in any case.
Okay.
I can tell you this. I doubt very much that they're from another planet and in any way that's really meaningful to us. This universe is a living being, and it's incredibly complex, and what they are and where they may be from is still very much of a mystery.
Yes.
I'll tell you one thing about this. And it's reflected in the book, and that is that very often, and this is something something that the MUFON types hate. People will report that they see their dead friends and relatives in the context of close encounter experiences with the Greys, as I did. And so that's just is an inkling of how very different
yes.
the answer to the question where they are from, where they may be from, may be from what we expect.
Yes. And also, as far as I can understand from your books, you really had a very, very intense bond, a very intense relationship with the female Grey.
Yes, I did. And
so it was, yes, and on the spiritual level, on the soul level, emotionally, physically, because...
Physically too, yes.
You got closer physically, but also emotionally. Was it a kind of a love story or something?
She wasn't a Grey like the little Greys that seemed to be the main ones. They were very ephemeral. She was a solid person.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were close to her, I had the impression, at least, that I was with a human being who was somehow mutated.
Okay, okay.
Perhaps even a person from the distant future.
Okay.
There was a sense of the human about her that certainly wasn't present when I met the little Greys in the forest at all.
Mm-hmm. Because it makes me feel that, it makes me think that you had a very spiritual, romantic, emotional bond with that female being.
I'm not sure that the word romantic fits in there. I had, in the sense that I was never aware of any volition on my part. In other words, when I had meetings with her, they were things I had that I was compelled to do. There were actions that I took that I couldn't do anything else. That just seemed to unfold. And so, you know, my wife and I was very concerned when this was happening because of my I have a wife and I'm married. I've taken a vow.
Excuse me, but I know that you have a wonderful wife.
Yeah.
You have a wonderful marriage and a son. I was going to ask you, what happened in your marriage when you started to experience these encounters with the beings? Was there any influences?
Well, when it first started, I did not know anything about it, and therefore I thought I was losing my mind. And at the time in New York, as I understood the law, if I had been had to be committed, my wife wouldn't have been able to divorce me. She would have been stuck until I was mentally well again, if I ever was. And I thought I was becoming psychotic, frankly, and so I kept trying to break our marriage up right at first. Before understand was never so relieved in her life than when I told her I thought I might have had an encounter with humans, because at least it began to make sense of it all. After it became more overt in December of 85, I started going to the doctor because I figured at that point it was obviously some kind of organic difficulty. I figured it was a brain tumor in my temporal lobe or temporal lobe epilepsy or something like that. I did not think of it as being anymore just being a psychotic thing. And so the stress on our marriage became less in a certain sense then. The last thing I wanted then was to break up with Anne because I really desperately wanted her in my life, and I loved her very much through the whole thing. Then when the woman came in, which was about a year later, she began to show up. The first indication that I had that she was around came from one of the editors at William Morrow & Company. Right after the book was published, he went into a bookstore in Manhattan, and he encountered her and her husband, he had a face-to-face encounter with them in this bookstore where they made it clear that they thought that the book was all wrong, and which, of course, she would do. I mean, if you met her for 5 seconds, you'd know exactly why she would think that was, A, funny, and, B, why it would probably be true, and, C, why she would want me to be in that state of unsureness. he's very interested in the growth of consciousness and a real master at it. And you don't grow in consciousness by having fun. You grow in consciousness by having questions that you can neither bear nor answer. Anyway, that was the first time I knew that she was somehow physically real. And then more real physically even than I had thought. And then there came some meetings from time to time, one in an apartment in Manhattan, where it was a very sexually intense experience for me, and one that I had no volition over. I couldn't change. And it was at that time that I thought that they were human beings that were mutated, that they were people, and maybe part gray, or God only knows, something that they've invented. I just don't know, but I do know this, that she is a brilliant and immensely difficult person, and someone very, very well worth knowing and having a relationship, and I miss her. I wish I would see her again, frankly, from time to time, but that's not to be, so...
Do you think that are there any fruits of this relationship as kids?
Well, it's a good question. I think there must be, because why... She's much too practical. I mean, it wasn't just for fun.
Was this a project?
It happened once in this apartment. It happened again at our cabin. And when it happened at our cabin, I woke up in the middle of the act, lying on my back with this person sitting on me. And the room was filled with people. The little man who was the guardian who stayed in the woods behind our house was there. And her husband was there, looking very much like her. And three military people were there, and they were all very disturbed, and they looked like they were, everyone was, except her, was looking like, you know, she was really lowering herself to do what she was doing.
Okay.
Well, Whitley, what was her attitude about it? She didn't appear to... She was lowering herself.
I couldn't see her face. Her face was blacked out, but the rest of her body was visible. And let's just say that she was functioning in a very energetic manner. I didn't have any impression that she was having any difficulty.
So do you think that all this relationship was a part of a scientific experiment or a project, including you and her?
No, not at all. A project, yes, but I don't think any scientific experiment, no.
Did you put something like this in the book, the fiction, the novel?
Yeah, there is stuff like this in the book.
Yeah, I mean, but the roles would be reversed, since I guess you have a heroine instead of a hero, is that right?
Well, yeah, the book is fairly complicated in that respect.
Uh-huh.
The hero of the book is really a little boy. And he doesn't get involved in any sex activities, of course. But the female protagonist, I should say, who is the empath, who works for the government, has a very different and much more complex situation. She doesn't get involved in any overt sex with the Greys, no. But she does get into a very ambiguous and difficult relationship where she realizes the overwhelming importance of what she's dealing with, but doesn't understand and has a lot of trouble making her way until one of the blondes is involved and gives her some direction. And this was another factor in my experience, in that the blondes came from time to time, and I met one of them whose existence is revealed, I guess, for the first time in the Greys, and I got to know him quite well, and he was adamantly opposed to the Greys. He just thought they were the most dangerous thing in the universe. But he would do that, because the creating of friction is very important. One of the Greys told Phil Corso, or communicated to Phil Corso, that what was on offer to us was a new world if we could take it. And that means two things. Everything always, everything that is communicated, especially when they communicate with words that come into the middle of your head, has more than one meaning. In fact, you have to understand that the words are just there as symbols, that the larger communication has all possible meanings that those words may contain and more. So a new world, if you can take it, means that we have to wrest it from their hands by proving that we are strong enough to do so, and also that we have to bear it because it is going to lead us into our own truth, and that is going to be really hard. But Delon, who communicated with me about the danger of the Greys, was really saying that we must approach them with open eyes, because they're the name of the game. They're who we're going to have to relate to in order to go forward. Nobody else is going to help us, because there's nobody else who's tough enough, strong enough, or willing.
Whitley, what do you think about the alien implants? Did you have, or do you have, an implant?
Well, I've got one in my ear, and I can't get rid of it, or I won't try again. But what do I think about them? Well, I think this. Maybe I have learned to use the one that I have, or maybe its presence and my attempts to use it have led me to another level of mind than I was at before. And the way I can use it is this. I can actually see, and vividly see, other worlds, I guess, in this universe. But I can go to them sometimes and see people moving about, and the closer they are to human form, the easier they are for me to make out. The farther away they are, the harder. And sometimes they're so far away from human form, I might see a place with a city in it and be able to move through all kinds of architecture and just have a wonderful experience and never see a living soul. And the reason I've discovered is that they're so different from us. The more different they are, the less information my mind has to put together and the less able I am to see them. But this is an extraordinary and phenomenal gift. I've used it in many different ways. I was able to find a world that was a little worse off than ours and one that was a little better off than ours, and see why in both cases. And I learned a great deal from that, and that's all reflected in the book. I learned a great deal from it.
So can we say that you had auto-body experiences? Is this a kind of astral travel?
No, it's more like television. I'm in my body when it happens. I've had some that were so intense that it wasn't even like being in and out of body. It was like being physically.
Physically, okay.
I have had lots of out-of-body experiences, though. I had one particularly fine one that was so vivid and so real. And I thought to myself, oh, hey, I've learned how to do this. This is going to really be cool. I've never been able to do it again. But I do know that it exists, certainly.
And talking about the physical changes, did you ever have any physical changes in the health-wise, positive or negative effects, after you started to communicate with them, after the interactions? I mean, did they affect your health?
Yeah, the first problem was allergies. I had a tremendous upsurge in allergies, and they started helping me by giving me visualizations of things I shouldn't eat, because when you're in close contact with them, the histamine, physical contact, histamine situation gets out of hand. When I used to have people to my cabin to come and see them and meet with them, and that happened a lot, I would warn people, I said, do not touch them, because if you touch them, you're going to have a big histamine reaction. And I was afraid someone would get sick, you know, get anaphylactic shock. And I had epinephrine injectors in the house in case that happened to me or somebody else. And this one woman, Raven Dana, when one of them showed up in her room, and here she was a person who was very at ease with all of this, and then the Gray shows up in her room, and first she thinks it's a raccoon, like a raccoon would come into the house in the middle of the night. And then she proceeds to put her hand out, and of course it reaches out and touches her hand, because the little Grays, the real, totally Gray Grays, are very, when they're close to you, if they've been willing to come close to you physically, it means they really like and trust you, because they'll put you in an altered state otherwise, because they're very fragile. And so she touches his hand, and she proceeds to have a big reaction. By the next afternoon, she's just like swollen closed. I thought we were going to have to take her to the hospital. And what was I going to say to him? Oh, she touched an alien, and she's having an allergic reaction? That wasn't going to go over.
Yes. And
so, well, fortunately, it went away. But, yeah, there's a lot of this physically.
Whitley, anything like that ever happened to you? Have you touched?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And that was why that...
You knew by experience that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I was warning people. And I had to go to the doctor, and I took... because they explained to me that what it was doing was raising my overall histamine level. And it, when I say explained, I'm using our language. They showed me, I would be the best way to put it. They demonstrated it in a certain way, which will become clearer, I hope, when you read the book. But anyway, that because the overall histamine level was rising, underlying allergies were liable to be triggered to innocent things, like mainly chocolate was the one they were most worried about. So I finally went to an allergist, and he said, yeah, you know, you do have an allergy to chocolate, actually. And he found a number of things I was allergic to and gave me injections to take home and take. And I took injections every day for years while I was, for the whole time, in fact, that I was dealing with the Graves. Then I eventually moved to Texas and went off the injections. And soon enough, I thought that the Grays would not show up there. And they did show up a couple of times. And the first time they showed up, what they did was they had their own allergy thing. And they stuck this thing in my little, it was just a little flat thing with a little tiny prick needle, like a smallpox needle on one side. And they pushed this into my arm. And I proceeded to lose all sensation in my skin. It was gone. Phenomenally weird. But I was with her in her being. And it was the lady from communion and in her real being. And I don't know how to explain this to you, but it takes you into a way of perceiving the world that's different from ours. And so the same world, but just looks very different. And it sounds different, and it feels different, and you feel like you are a Gray, and you're part of them in a certain way. And then in the next morning, I wake up, and I'm still numb. And so I didn't realize anything was wrong. I had had this contact with her. I was wide awake when it happened. I went and took my shower, and the water starts hitting me, and it sounded, I could hear it. And it was sort of thumping inside my body a little bit, but I realized I have no sensation at all in my skin. So I figured, well, hopefully this will come back, otherwise I'm just going to have to live like this. I dry myself off, and it's a very weird experience. I go out and I turn on the radio. I can't understand the English language. It's just gibberish. So I sit there and I listen and I concentrate on the radio, and I feel like I've been a million miles away for years, frankly, is how it felt. And gradually I get it back again. Then we try to go to Mass, to church. And get in the car. I can't drive a foot. I mean, I'm so confused. We end up at the end of a runway at the airport. I'm just totally disoriented. I'm driving at random almost. I mean, we weren't on the runway. We were on a little access road that I don't know how the hell I got onto. But that's what it's like. So, yeah, there were physical effects is the answer, the long answer.
This is very scary. This is very scary. And I was also wanted to ask you, except the allergic reactions and the other scary things, how does it feel when they touch you or when you touch them? How does it feel their skin? Is it soft or humid or dry?
I'm not so sure I can answer that because I haven't been touched much. At the first night that I recall it feeling like deer skin, and they had also the little blue guys were there, these little blue frog-like people who seemed to be somehow connected to and part of the Grays. They had gloves on that were sort of soft, too. I've not been much touched. I will say this, though. One of them jumped on my back one time, and... Now this was one that was more in the human form, not like the little Grays. This was one that was about 4 feet tall, like the lady on the cover of Communion, but different. And it was like iron. She's real thin legs and arms, but you couldn't even think about getting her off. It was it, I don't even know what it was. It was like being in an iron vise. Absolutely amazing strength. Like she was made of steel.
Yes. Yes. Do they have their names? Do they have the concept of name?
No. They do have identities, but I don't think there are any names. It's not like us in that respect. The identity is the way I would identify them, by the way they made me feel when I was near them.
Okay.
When we come back, we want to talk to Whitley Strieber some more about abductions and one of Farrah's favorite subjects, vampires. Hold on, Whitney. We'll be back with you right after this word. And naturally, we want to mention that your new novel, The Grays, will be coming out on August 22nd. As we continue with more of Meet the Icon, Whitley Strieber. Stand by.
My Search for the Afterlife is a book that explores real communications between a father and his deceased son. Uniquely authored from beyond the grave and co-authored in this world, the book chronicles the miraculous journey of communication beyond death. Learn more about the book, My Search for the Afterlife. Visit their website at www.mysearchfortheafterlife.com. That's mysearchfortheafterlife.com.
That was from the soundtrack of the 1993 movie version of Dracula. And the reason we played that is because during this half hour, as we continue our visit with guest Whitley Strieber on the line from Southern California, yes, we will be talking about vampires. And what is more fitting than to talk about vampires as we are joined by special correspondent Farrah Yardoza, who wrote a book about vampires, didn't you? It was published in your native land, Turkey. Anyway, Farrah, welcome to the show. Later on, executive producer Larry Dickin will be joining us. But right now, let's get back to Whitley. Whitley, thanks for hanging on. And I believe Farrah wants to talk to you about abductions.
Okay. Are there other abductees in your family or contactees in your family?
Well, my uncle, who's passed on, was the... He and General Arthur Exon were the sources for the book Majestic. It's another example of a fiction that I could, because I couldn't prove any of it. I had no documentation, but they told me the whole story of Roswell in great detail. Art Exon started out by saying, Whitley, you have to understand, within 24 hours of our finding this thing, everybody from Truman on down knew it was not of this world. They explained the reason for the secrecy. The initial reason was that we had the 509th bomb wing in Roswell, and this was an excursion by an unknown aircraft that had crashed within 30 miles of that site, and the possibility that it might be Russian was very much in everyone's minds. And the problem was the 509th was what Stalin was afraid of, and he had 4.5 million troops spread across Central Europe at that time, and he could have moved those troops to the English Channel in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, his fear was he would be attacked with atomic bombs. Our secret was the 509th in 1947 looked operational, and we had spread the belief that we had 8 atomic weapons. We had none, and we would not have any until at the earliest 1950. So we were really the whole free world depended on that bomb wing not being Stalin not discovering that there were no real atomic bombs there. So that was the first reason for the secrecy. The second reason for the secrecy was that the Air Force felt like they had flubbed it, that there had been an attempt at contact from another world and they messed it up. And so Truman decided, we'll just let this thing ride for a while. The visitors on their part decided to try to communicate with us, and in 1954, there was a massive attempt to communicate in Washington. We remained silent. If you can imagine people going out into a chimpanzee troop and say, and trying to talk to the chimpanzees and saying, how are you fellas, we'd like to get to know you better. The chimpanzees, of course, entirely ignore them. They have no idea what's going on. That's how the visitors perceived us as reacting in Washington in 1954 in July.
Yes.
So then they began this whole process of building a communications system within the human species that would be able to use our own good minds to rise into this new level of being that would enable us to relate to them. That's what the abductees are about. That's what the implants support. That's what it's all about. Now, they're not saints, don't get me wrong. And they are also very free, and there are those that come here that don't come here with the best intentions. They get off on us in very, very weird and disturbing ways. They are a big, complicated, bizarre reality that we're just going to have to get used to. But they do want us. They want us in the world, and they want to relate to us because I think they find us fascinating.
Did you ever feel yourself as if you are a prey and they are the hunters?
Oh, absolutely.
Are they hunting here?
A time when I went down to the woods and I couldn't proceed, afterwards I wondered, were those cries the cries of a disappointed predator or a disappointed lover, or both?
Yes, yes.
It seems like almost it could be both, right, Whitley?
Oh, absolutely. It definitely. I think that the lamb lies down with the lion as long as the lion's not hungry.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
This interview means a lot for me, Whitley, because the first time when I read your book, The Hunger, it was 15 years ago, and I was very much influenced by your novel, The Hunger. And later you wrote other vampire books, other vampire novels. Now, I can see, this is my personal opinion, of course, I can feel or sense a kind of connection between vampires and the visitors. Because...
Very definitely, and also between the Wolfen and the visitors. And
yes, Wolfen also.
The first book, The Wolfen, it's about highly intelligent gray predators with large, extraordinary eyes that are called the Wolfen.
Yes.
And the second book... It's about another type of much more subtle and charming and predator who is tall and blonde and very ageless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I mean, well, I think that I was involved with them all my life.
Yes.
And I just didn't know it consciously, and they were the wellspring of my creativity.
All your life, yes, this is what I feel. Imagine that vampires and visitors come in the nighttime. They are the creatures of the night, and vampires...
Yes.
They are the creatures of the night, yes.
Yeah, they are the creatures of the night. They don't come during the day. The blondes do. They can come in the day, but the grays don't. They come at night.
Yes. And vampires need human blood for their life. And grays or the extraterrestrial visitors need human sperm and egg for their own something. We don't know what. So...
Well, they take it, certainly.
Yes, they take it.
They took it from me that first night. I discovered about... a year now ago, what actually happened, if you look at the hypnosis transcripts of that first night, I get an erection and I'm saying, you know, where did that come from? I'm literally saying that I'm getting an erection and I don't know why and I don't have any sex feelings at all. I later discovered that there is a device called an ele- and there's been enormous numbers of jokes made about the rectal probe, which is about, so far, our culture, that is really what's penetrated our culture, is the face of the gray alien and the rectal probe joke. And that's as far as we've come. We're not doing too well, but then again, we always kind of come at things ass backwards, and in this case, I mean perhaps that literally. In any case, this thing was put into me, and I later discovered that it's called an electrostimulator. That in those days they were used in clinics for people who had men who couldn't get erections. This was put into them and it stimulates the nerve electrically that controls erections and it makes the penis go erect. And they use it in animal routinely to get the bulls and the horses and things rolling when they need to get sperm from them. And
mm-hmm.
living in the woods behind our house, the neighborhood, the people in the area, some of them knew things. Like our next door neighbor saw a lot of lights over the house often, and word spread in the community that there was really something going on there. And then communion came out, and given the other things that those people in that area knew, there were a lot of people. I made this stone circle where I was first abducted from, and I used to go there and meditate. And I had to be careful at night because I would sit and shit if I wasn't careful, because people would defecate in it. And they were hostile to me. They were very scared and very hostile. And so I would have to somehow deal with that. And this little man showed up and began living in the woods behind us. I at first thought he was a child when I first saw him. But we came to realize that he wasn't a child. He had the affect of the grays. He was very testy. He was very quick. He was extremely skilled with his hands. He was very nervous. He used to smoke all the time, and he would hang out there. And if Ann and I ever went skinny dipping in our pool, which we liked to do because it was very private, he would run back and forth in the woods behind the trees, breaking sticks and gasping in order to, because it embarrassed him terribly for us to go outside like that. And he was, I think, a hybrid. I think he was part human and part gray. And I think that that's part of what they're doing, is to create in varying degrees some kind of hybridization in an effort to build this bridge.
So do you think that there are many hybrid people around us in the world right now? A new creation?
I don't often encounter people I think are hybrids. I have encountered one, a young woman in Mexico who I am pretty sure her mother believes that she is the result of one of these sexual relationships, and that she was supposed to go with them and didn't and ended up with us. And she's a lovely, brilliant, and extremely fragile young woman with very big eyes. And she's really extraordinary, beautiful, beautiful person. Extremely secretive, her family is, and I can understand why, and so I respect that.
Did you write about her in your new book, Grace?
No, I don't write about her at all.
So, okay.
At the request of her family, it was a privilege even to meet her.
I see. And you were visited by another mysterious man when you were staying in Toronto, in Canada. He came one night and he spoke with you.
Mm.
And do you think that was he a hybrid or was he a man in black?
He was, I'll describe him and you can make your own decision, conclusions. He was about 5'7", maybe. He was not a big man. In other words, he was noticeably compact individual. He was gray, very white hair, very kindly face with a rather sharp sort of nose. I thought he was a waiter from a hotel. I mean, that's how he initially impressed me. And he was, I never had the impression there was anything unusual about him in terms of his humanity. It was just that what he said, what I transcribed in that book, The Key, yes. I think it was one of the most remarkable conversations. Certainly it's the most remarkable conversation I've ever had. And I think that the man was in possession of the secrets of the ages, whoever he was.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And do you consider yourself as a psychic?
I don't want to be a psychic, but I am one. And I also have a lot of contact with the dead. And I just do. And that's... I have to accept that.
Yeah. Whitley, when you talk about contact with the dead, some sort of vibes or thoughts, or is there actual conversations? Or?
No. There can be conversations. It can even be physical at times. Very much.
So someone that you know that has passed away suddenly is there.
And when they appear physically, I never realize they're dead until after they've gone. And then suddenly it hits me, oh my God, of course, how can that be? He's dead. Like I had a dear friend who appeared at a party about 6 months after he died, and he was at the party, and I said to my wife, let's go over and talk to Oliver. And she said, Whitley, he's dead. And he looked at us so disappointed and then just disappeared.
So you were the only one seeing him at the time?
Yeah, apparently. And that happens to me a lot.
Uh-huh.
I get that a lot. And
Do you get a clue about what happens? I didn't mean to interrupt you, Farrah.
Not really. I just sort of roll with it. I've learned everything bizarre that can happen to somebody, sort of psychic and edge stuff, happens to me, including journeys into the past, the future, and other planets. I am completely unstuck in space-time, and I just roll with it. You know, I used to just be frantic about it, and what's real and what's not, and having all these questions. The hell with all of that. I can't answer the questions, so I just roll with it. It's the way I am, the way I live.
Do you still work with tarot cards, with tarot?
No, I never really did that. I had that lay of the tarot cards called The Path, which I published a little book about that was on my website for a while. But I never used them as a conjuring thing. I just never did that. That doesn't interest me, although I think it's possible, and I think that they work probably the same way the I Ching works. But it's not something I was ever interested in. I'm a here and now kind of guy. The future will figure itself out when it comes.
But there are, we can use tarot cards for other purposes, not only to predict the future.
Well, that's true. And in a sense, The Path was one lay of the tarot cards that enables us to kind of see where we are on the path of life, and where we stand, and what our ground is. So yeah, in that sense, I use them, but I don't like take out my pack of tarot cards and fool around with them at all.
So, which tarot card represents you in the deck?
The Path was shown to me in the Marseille Tarot, and that's the only one I've ever had anything to do with. I have to be honest with you, it doesn't interest me very much. The Path was very interesting, but the rest of the stuff and all the special decks and things, I don't relate to that.
Okay.
I agree with you, Whitley. However, Farrah is quite the tarot reader.
As I say, it's not my thing.
Okay, so what is your approach to New Age? And there are crystal child, crystal children, indigo children, star children discussions. So what is this?
I think a lot of it is wishful thinking and imagination, and a lot of it is a response to the fact that this species is in contact and is struggling to find its way with this, and is struggling to find a spiritual connection that will work and be effective and bring us into the joy that we sense is there, and not lead us into the darkness that we also sense is there. I think that's what the New Age is really about.
And again, if I'm not wrong, you had, or you still have, two very strong feelings for your visitors, love and fear.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
At the same time, you love them, and they scare you. You have fear. So how do you deal with these two strong feelings against them or towards them?
Well, I think if I had a pet tiger, I feel pretty much toward the pet tiger the way I feel toward the grave. I don't think you should reconcile the two feelings. They're both together, and in the grays, in the book, it's very ambiguous as to whether or not they're going to be dangerous. I think we have to decide what they're going to be to us, and that they present themselves in this ambiguous way so that we will make this decision on our own. That one thing that is very, very clear, they're not involved politically at all. There's one thing that happened in the whole time I was with the Greys that they reacted to.
You mean one political thing?
I'll tell you what that is, but the reason they're not involved, the reason they hold back, and the reason they present this ambiguous appearance to us, is they want, and the reason they're so secretive about themselves, is they want us to come freely into ourselves and into the cosmos, not as supplicants and not as believers, but simply as ourselves as we really are. And they are extremely, profoundly free. The idea that they're a hive mind and so forth is just a fantasy. When you read the Greys, you will see how they work in triads, and you will see how free those triads actually are, and how very different they are from us, because each one of us is a completely self-contained triad. But the political thing was this. The first Gulf War, they reacted to with utter and complete contempt. And I was fascinated by this, because I thought to myself, well, and I thought to them, why? I mean, the guy did something terrible. He attacked this other country, and he's stealing all of our oil. And I got the impression that there was a letter involved. And about a year later, I came across the information that the United States ambassador to Saddam Hussein...
You're talking about April Glass.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
...sent that letter to Saddam that seemed to endorse an invasion of Kuwait.
Right, and we've discussed that many times. And that's interesting.
You see, they saw where this would lead.
The time is about up here. Whitley, and Farah, you have any closing comments or questions?
Yes, one more thing. Our contact, our interactions with Greys or visitors mean a lot to me. And as far as I can see, they make us happy and they make us unhappy, just like the life itself. Life makes us happy and unhappy at the same time. So they are not very different than the life itself. Thank you very much, Whitley. Thank you very much, Jerry. It was nice to talk to both of you.
It is. Whitley, you got any closing comments? Anything? I know the book is doing well.
Well, the book is not out yet. It'll be published in...
Well, I meant by public relations. It's doing well.
Yeah, it is. It's getting good early reviews.
And I imagine one worries about that. You can sometimes hit a peak before you're ready. But at the same time...
But I hope everybody buys it, because if they do, it's an expression of the fact that we may be able to go on with this. And if it sits on the shelves, it's going to mean a lot to the Greys. And we may have to...
In other words, you're answering my final question already, and I haven't asked it, and that is, how do the Greys feel about the book, The Greys?
Very well aware of the book in every detail. The Greys and the book are... This book, more than any book I've ever written about the Greys, is very much with them. They were very present in the process. And, as I say, if it's embraced, then a communication has succeeded. If it's not embraced, it's failed.
Well, actually, it would probably be to the benefit of everyone that if this were made into a movie. Books get wide circulation, but certainly don't compare to movies.
That's why the movie is being done. And if we succeed with it, and there are forces that are against it, there's lots of people... you'd talk to MUFON and they'd like the Greys to just go away. And this would like this extraordinary chance to be abandoned. It's abandoned. And I hope it won't be.
You were almost out of time, but what do you attribute this type of thinking to? And there's a lot of it around, as you say.
Fear.
Good answer.
It's all fear. I mean, yes, they're a mixed bag, but God, so are we.
No one would argue with that statement, Whitley.
A few years ago, you could have had communists, Nazis, Democrats, Republicans, all going to other planets, and it would still be just as crazy with Muslims and Christians and. Everybody, if we were as free to go to other worlds as they are, wherever they come from, we would be meeting, the people on those worlds would be meeting something that is just as complicated as the Greys, and just as equivocal, just as wonderful and just as dangerous, and that would be us.
I think that's a good way to close the show. Farah, I've enjoyed it. And Whitley, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Jerry and Farah. It was an enormous pleasure and a joy. Thank you.
Whitley Strieber was our icon for this week's show, an interesting fellow for sure. When we come back, Larry Dickham will join us, Farah Yudoza, and myself, as we go around the table discussing Whitley Strieber's work over the years, his UFO experiences, and his new book, The Grays, coming out August 22nd.
I'm Jim Mars, author of Alien Agenda, the world's top-selling nonfiction book on UFOs. I'm here today to tell you one of the most fascinating stories I've come across in my career as a journalist. The secret of Reggae is that so many people in one small American community now know that there is so much more to the universe than what we see and experience in our everyday world.
Save $5 this month when you purchase The Secret of Redgate DVD from ShopJerryPippin.com. This film won the prestigious People's Choice Awards at the 2004 UFO Conference. The Secret of Redgate will astound you. You will want to see it again and again. Save $5. Order it now, this month only, at ShopJerryPippin.com. Secret of Redgate, a Linda Cowan production. Welcome back to Meet the Icon. We just finished talking with Whitley Strieber, noted author, radio program host, and experiencer. Larry Dickin has now joined us as we do a closing discussion about our interview with Whitley. Welcome to the show again, Larry. You were away during most of the interview. I wish you'd been here. I know you would have had some good questions for him. But you did get to hear some of the interviews, so we invited you to come back and get your opinion, as well as Farah's. And we'll get to you in a moment, Larry. But first of all, Farah, you asked Whitley some pretty interesting questions there, kid. I thought he was very candid, didn't you?
I really enjoyed this interview. Everything was very nice, and I really had many questions to ask him. I don't think that I asked all the questions that I had in my mind because of the time limitations, but I feel privileged because of this interview. I'm very happy about it.
Now, as far as Whitley Strieber himself is concerned, Larry Dickin, he's really one of the more successful UFO writers. And in the interview, he said he wrote The Grays as fiction. He told Farah, to a direct question, I am paraphrasing here, but basically he said because that was an easier way to tell a very complex story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I absolutely agree. Taking any real event and fictionalizing it, in popularizing it, making it understandable to people, I think if you're going, especially if you're going to make a movie, is that's the way to go. Don't go with a strictly down to earth factual treatment of the thing, because it'll be boring. You got to give it some life, and don't be surprised that you're going to see. In Whitley's movie, you're going to see some romance. I know the movies that he's done have been associated with in the past, that has been the case.
Farah, I thought you asked some pretty interesting and intimate questions there about this romance with this gray alien, female type.
Yes, of course. I mean, it is very obvious in Whitley Strieber books.
I've only heard of one other story in all of the decades I've been doing UFO shows, where there was a romantic, an intimate meeting,
well,
an encounter.
Well, it happens not only with the Strieber, the other abductees or contactees that I met in the years, in the United States and in my own native country in Turkey, they really experienced this romantic, very intense, sometimes love relationship, and they get attached, and they feel this bond. They have this bond during all their lives, and I'm not surprised because I saw this in many cases. And the nice thing is that with the Schreiber is very open and very honest to share his own feelings with us, because this is really very intimate.
Yeah, Larry, you and I have talked about this many times out the air, very seldom on the air, but it seems to me that there are probably more encounters with extraterrestrials and human beings on an emotional level than we know.
Well, I think that's true. I don't think that other extraterrestrial beings are going to be visiting this planet, strictly to use and abuse. I think, certainly there are cases reported where it seems like all that's happening is use and abuse. But this primarily comes from these little, very small grays, the ones that are like 3 feet tall, which appear actually to be some form of biological entity that is artificially produced and cloned. And it's an equivalent to, conceptually, to what humans think of as androids or automatons that have intelligence and, can act on their own, but they don't really have what we would call a soul or a spirit. However, there are, in many encounters between humans and ETs, there are other beings present, and these beings do show emotion, they do show feeling, and that is the interaction that often occurs.
You know, we can go through our interview, our gallery of interviews, especially with the experiencers, and there are cases where that's hinted at, but most people don't really talk too much about it. Farrah, you're
well,
right about
it,
that.
And the thing is what Farrah said is true. It's a very personal, intimate affair, if you want to call it that, between two intelligent species, members of, and it's like two people getting together. Is you don't necessarily want to share your total private life with people.
Well, this is the first of a series of shows we'll do called Meet the Icon. It had to be special people that are in the media, and hopefully we'll have both of you back on another show about this soon. Farrah, you need to keep in mind that when you get the interview, you're definitely going to be part of the show. Thank you very much for all the work you
thanks
do.
Thanks a lot.
You
thank
do
you
so
very
well.
Much. Thanks to you. Thanks to Larry. It was a great experience for
now,
me.
Now, do you have any closing thoughts or comments after this interview? You have anything that really jumped out at you?
Oh, well, you know what? This interview was very inspiring. So I just started to think about who will be our next guest for our interview. yes.
Larry, you have always been a big help with us and do lots of research, and we usually talk about scientific things, but I know you're interested in some of the things that Whitley talked about, the emotional bonds.
Right. Well, as you know, we've had discussions on offline, is that I'm personally into a lot of spirituality, and I think that is what comes through with Whitley as well. Having read his books, I can assure you that message is there. And the congruence currently of the perception of us humans that spirituality and science aren't necessarily divorced, that they can intertwine and interact. They are, in fact, one and the same. And I think, again, that comes through from Whitley's writings.
We'd like to thank Whitley Strieber again. The name of the book is The Grays, and it is a great read. And in addition to that, looks like it's going to be a great movie. Farrah Yedoza and Larry Dickin, thank you very much.
Okay, Jerry.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
This program has been produced and directed by Jerry Pippin Productions and the whole crew. It was a little joint effort. Until next time, on behalf of Farrah and Larry, thank you for listening. Cheers.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want